This week on Pop of Culture, it's Life in Bloom.
And I said, who gets to do this? Who gets to stand there where Bob stood and interpret one of his paintings through flowers?
PBS host and florist Jay Schwanke joins us to talk about his flower-filled life and to convince us that everyone can be a floral arranger.
And we'll speak to musician Dana Powell on the release of her debut album. Coming up,
Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by Psi Iota Xi. Additional support comes from the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, and sustaining members of IPR. You can support local programming today at indianapublicradio.org.
From IPR, this is Pop of Culture. I'm Jen Blackmer.
And I'm Michelle Kinsey. Jen, you have a new conversation between the coasts for us today.
I do. We are always seeking out artists of all types who have made the choice to live and work away from the coastal cultural hubs. And I am so thrilled to be here today with Jay Schwanke, who is the flower guy. He's the creator and host of Life in Bloom, which you can catch on Ball State PBS. And Jay, welcome to Pop of Culture.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here. So it's wonderful.
I'm excited to have a conversation with you, most certainly. And as the flower guy, obviously we're going to talk a lot about flowers, but because this is Pop of Culture, we're also going to be talking about your journey as an artist and how you came to do this thing that you do. And so I'm going to ask you first off about your journey as an artist, but I want to start with the fact that you were born at a flower convention. Is that true? And give us some details.
Absolutely. So yes, it's true. I think that I was born for this job. my mom and dad were the executive directors of the Nebraska Florist Society. And so that meant that they ran an association for about 400 florists in the state of Nebraska. My dad also ended up being the president of the Society of American Florists. And my mother was a professional floral communicator, and they traveled, and they're infamous in the flower industry. Right. And so they were running this grower school in March of 1960. And my mother suddenly turned to my dad and said, "We need to go somewhere to have this baby," because she was very pregnant. And she said, "My water just broke and I think it's time." And my dad said, "Have you looked outside?" There was 19 inches of snow in Hastings, Nebraska that weekend. And he said, they've closed the roads. And they paged the front desk. There was a general practitioner there who delivered me in room 386 of the Hastings Hotel.
That is incredible. And there really was a doctor in the house, right? So that's like the cliche. Thank goodness, hey, is there a doctor in the house?
A practitioner who took care of it all. Yes. So,
did they put a flower in your fist or something, in your little baby fist? And
no, but I'm a fourth generation florist. My family, 1896, my great grandfather started our family business in Fremont, Nebraska. He purchased a bankrupt greenhouse that grew palms for people, this Victorian homes. And then it, over time, you know, became a flower shop where we had 7 acres under glass where we raised the flowers that we cut and sold to the general public.
Oh, that's awesome. And so you really had no choice. I mean, fourth generation flower family. I mean, this was sort of your calling, right?
Well, I think it's very interesting when you say that, because so people refer to me as the flower expert. And That's sometimes confusing for people. I am not the garden expert. I'm not going to tell you where to garden and where to plant a hydrangea. I have no idea. But I can tell you about every type of cut flower that probably exists to man, and mm-hmm. how it responds being a cut flower, how long it will last arranging it, how to arrange it, those types of things. So I think that that's important. But here's the great story that goes with that. So when I was in high school, I was a junior, and I had an amazing, one of the people I still think so much of, and is still alive in Fremont, Nebraska. Her name is Jan Therian, and she was my guidance counselor. And she called me into her office and she said, "You know, your parents say you have to go to college. You have to go to college, and we need to determine what you are going to do for a living. because that is what you should go to college for. And since your parents have this open invitation to go, you need to go. Mm-hmm. And she said, what do you think? And I said, and so my entire life, I love animals. I love flowers the most, but I love animals second. And I said, I would love to be a zookeeper. And she said, oh dear. She said, you don't do well in math or science. You know, you're very good in art, but you know, though you're not highly skilled, and you're going to basically have to become a doctor. And this is going to take a lot of dedication and a lot of hard work. And you know, you're basically lazy. And I was like, yes, please tell me more. And she said, I said, what do you think I should do? And she said, you know, you already know more about flowers than anyone I know. And you've grown up in it. I literally ran through the flowers in the greenhouse every single day of my life. That's what I did. And she said, you should become a florist because it will be easy. You'll be good at it and it will be wonderful. And I was like, okay, that's what we're going to do. And so it was interesting because at that point in time, I had already started to work at the flower shop and I was already involved in the flower business and the management of the people there. And I would go into work in the morning and get everybody set for their day. And then I would go to school and then I would come back home. And it was just like, it was a very family oriented business. I worked with my mother, my father, my grandfather. There was I think 13 at the most at one point in time, family members and a lady who worked for us for 90 years. So it was crazy, you know, or 67 years. She was 90, but she worked for us for 67 years. But so I knew that that was what I wanted, you know, that was a good thing to do. And so I decided to go to the little parochial college in my hometown so that I could work and go to college at the same time.
And this was in Hastings, yes?
In Fremont, Nebraska. Fremont, Nebraska, Lincoln, Nebraska, and Omaha form a triangle, mm-hmm. about 40 miles apart. And I graduated there with a degree in marketing and another degree in public relations, which has served me very well.
But I'll bet,
long for the ornamental horticulture piece. And so now in Jan Therian's defense, I always want her to come on the show. I want her to come and tell the story and let me tell the story about her because I think she's divine. And she's just like, I am not doing that.
It's funny. The mentors in our life are oftentimes the ones that don't want the spotlight, even though they were instrumental.
Yeah, I was just so thankful she was honest. Yeah. She cared about me and she was like, you won't succeed at that. You're going to succeed at this. And I say to her, the proof of the pudding is, you know, that I have a national television show that's in, you know, 97% of the market in all 50 states. And people love Jay Schwanke's Life in Bloom. And
that's
so
right. We're getting ready to start season 7. Yes.
I did the right thing. Jan gave me the perfect advice. So, yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, that's great. So, there's an art to flower arranging, obviously. I mean, things make us, we love to surround ourselves with things that are aesthetically pleasing. But I have this suspicion that you feel that flowers do more than that, right? What are some of the more perhaps unusual reasons that people may want to invite flowers into their lives?
So the whole basis of our show was to talk to people about the health and wellness benefits of flowers. I told you that my father was the president of the Society of American Florists. Mm-hmm. And when he was there, he established a foundation for floristry. Him and several other gentlemen got together and they created the American Floral Endowment. And what that did for many years was fund research by Dr. Haviland Jones, who is still alive to this day. I believe she's 98 years old. She doesn't grant interviews anymore, but she did so much work at Rutgers University, at Boston University. And since then, many other people have jumped on the bandwagon and they have done other research. But there's these amazing pieces of research that prove to us that, first of all, flowers make us have happier thoughts. Mm-hmm. They reduce our stress. They lower our blood pressure when we're in the presence of flowers. If we are sick and we receive flowers, we get better faster. So seniors who are surrounded or are in the presence of flowers will enlarge their circles of friends. They'll be more apt to seek medical attention for something that ails them. They will have less depressing thoughts and less despair. If there's flowers in your workplace, you're apt to be more creative. So these things start to happen. Now, the interesting thing about that is it happens with being in the presence of flowers, but it also happens with being in the presence of flower images or in the presence of plants. These things all work together. I was watching a Colbert show the other night with a gentleman who was talking about how we can release endorphins and release dopamine without drug stimulation. I mean, that's one of the problems with opiates is that they do that for us, but they're opiates and then we become addicted to them.
Right.
And so they were giving music is another thing that makes our body release these endorphins. But so do flowers. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, when we started our show in 1999, is that correct? 2019, sorry. 2019. In 2019, when we started our show, that was our driving force, was to bring these pieces together and start to tell people about the health and wellness benefits of flowers. And it's been something that's kind of been on our radar in the US for a long time. So like, just as an example, when you go to Amsterdam, when you go to someone's house, you bring flowers.
Right. Yes.
That's the thing. And my Amsterdam friends joke, oh, you're Americans, you bring wine and help us drink half of it. And I mean, you know, that's hysterical. But so you bring flowers. And we've always tried to teach Americans to have a more European embrace of what flowers are like and how you bring them and have them in your home. Well, we started our show and then the pandemic hit.
Yeah, yeah.
And people were unplugging from cable, but they were still watching public television. They were seeing our show. They had to go to the grocery store to buy supplies. They saw the flowers. They picked them up. And they started to experience, and there was this sudden boon in flower purchases throughout the entire pandemic, bigger than we've ever seen in the history of flowers in this United States. And really, I mean, you know, the thing that was happening was people were experiencing for themselves, I can pick up this bouquet of flowers along with these eggs and bread and I can take it home and hey, you know what? I feel better.
Yeah.
I'm not sad. Yeah. Not arguing as much in our home. And all of those things started to come together. And since then, that weekly pickup of flowers along with groceries has been extremely popular and hasn't lost track.
Oh, I love hearing that. I think that's great. And it dovetails, I think, with this resurgence in an interest in heritage crafts, too, at that particular time. I mean, like baking bread and, you know, things that have been with humans for, you know, hundreds of years, really.
It's so interesting because my parents, I mean, I learned through osmosis, obviously, through my father, my grandfather, my mother, my grandmother, and designers who worked at the store. But my parents wanted me to be classically trained in floral design. So they, when I was 17, sent me to Japan to study Ikenobo, which is a school of Ikebana flower design, so that I could be trained classically in the art of flower design. And then they also, I mean, I've been to many schools, including one by Phil Rolota, who is a he's an icon and a mentor in the flower industry. He has he's the one who taught me the elements and principles of floral design. And then florists have this weird thing that they do is they, and I don't know if they still do it, but my parents sure were involved in it. My dad had two best friends and they all traded children for a year. And so
what?
I went to work for one, I went to go to live with this other family where I worked in the wholesale division of floristry. And I actually dyed carnations. That was my job. And then, you know, my parents took a girl who was in a grower situation where her family grew plants and brought her into our retail establishment. And then the guy from the wholesale department went to work for the grower. So we, the three of us traded kids for a year and we got to learn other aspects of the flower industry.
Wow. How about that? So I want to go back to something you had said earlier about your mother. You said that your mother was a floral communicator. Can you tell me what that is and what that involves?
Okay, so in our industry, many years ago, florists would teach each other by having these events on weekends at wholesale distributors where they would gather sometimes 70, sometimes 1,200, depending upon where you were in the country, and they would be taught how to arrange. Generally, there was a panel of four or five designers and then a professional flower communicator or a commentator at that time who would tell the audience what they were seeing and explain things, because sometimes creative people don't express themselves as well. They're very good at what they're doing, but they don't know how to teach it to somebody. And so kind of like a teacher that would head the class to allow them to learn what they were doing. Now, in the flower industry, there are many designers who are also communicators. I've literally done thousands of those types of educational events in the flower industry in the US. Then when before the pandemic even rolled around, we started to see those were dying off. I mean, there was a lot more information being available online and stuff, so those live events didn't happen as much. Mm-hmm. And what we're noticing now, we're about 10 or 15 years into that lack of those live educational events. And hearsay and old wives' tales are taking over, and people aren't using the best methods. And a lot of people are making mistakes that I would teach people not to make because I had made them myself. You teach people about flowers one person at a time. Now, there may be 70 people in a group, but I'm going to have to connect to each of those people in an individual way to make sure they understand what I've said and how it relates to them and the mm-hmm. best way for them to utilize that information.
And individuals have different aesthetic responses to things as well. So they will want to make different choices.
And you know, the best part about these educational events I would give is people would come up afterwards and say, okay, let me tell you my story. Perfect. Let's see how this relates to you.
Yeah.
And let's help you. And you know what? That's what I love about public television and my show, is that I get hundreds, literally hundreds of emails every week from people who are watching the show. And some of them are like, you know, hey, I have this vase and I made this arrangement in it, and what do you think of it? Or do you think I could put red roses in this vase? You know, and much of it is just someone granting them permission, correct?
Right. Yeah, of course.
At the same time, we get ones, we had a lady who her husband developed cancer and she was in her home and she was feeling her whole world closing in on her, and she found our show. And she watched the show and she would tape them so that she could replay them, because that brought comfort and it brought assurance to her. And then she shared that her husband passed away, and now she has that loss, but she's replaced that loss with our show.
Right.
You know, I'm going to bring it back to you in that Bob Ross is a hero of mine. Bob Ross and Mr. Rogers have influenced and mentored my show so much because they make people feel good. And making people feel good is a rare commodity these days. And so we want to continue that work. And that's what we're going to do.
It's so important nowadays, especially. And you mentioned Bob Ross, and there is actually a Bob Ross themed episode coming up in season 7, is there not? And you were here in Muncie.
I was. So, I made myself a promise the other day that I need to start laughing and having more fun and not being emotional and crying so much. because I'm an emotional person. But I met Joan Kowalski, and she was at our American Public Television Fall Marketplace with Nicholas.
Nicholas who?
Nicholas Hankins. He is the new host of The Joy of Painting. He is a certified Bob Ross painter, and he's wonderful. He is so cool, because when you talk to him, it's almost like talking to Bob himself. He embodies Bob Ross's work so incredibly.
Well, so much so that he's doing the new Joy of Painting. Is that correct?
Correct. The unfinished canvases. So he's taking 12 of Bob Ross's unfinished canvases and finishing them. So Joan Kowalski is the CEO of, is the president of Bob Ross Inc. Well, last year she came up to me and said, I want to give you a opportunity to come to where Bob stood in his studio that was inside that home that the Ball family had donated for his studio.
Yeah.
And have you interpret one of his paintings through flowers. And so then she said, well, you need to pick out a painting. And there is only one painting that Bob did that has flowers in it. And it was in season 26, episode 5. And it's called A Trace of Spring.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so then they set up A Trace of Spring and allowed me to bring in an arrangement and make an arrangement. And Joan met me there and she guested on the show as well. And I have to tell you that when you go to the Bob Ross Experience, it's an amazing, amazing experience because there's a place on the ground where, like, you know, where he'd beat the devil out of the brushes and it would splatter the paint. And there's like two footprints where his feet always were.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when I came in and my crew had already been there and they'd all been working with Brian Statz from Mini Trista Museum and bless Brian's heart, because he was standing there and he's like, well, Jay, I think we're all ready for you. Does everything look okay? And I was just like, and I was just sobbing like a baby.
Oh, wow. It was a spiritual experience.
Right. And Brian was like, is everything okay? I was like, it's perfect. Everything is perfect. And I said, who gets to do this? Who gets to stand there where Bob stood and interpret one of his paintings through flowers? And he's like, well, you do.
Yep.
You get to do this. And it was just so, I mean, that's the pinnacle of my career. I mean, right now, that's the pinnacle of my career is that, you know, I got to stand where Bob stood and I got to interpret something that Bob created. It's mind blowing. It's mind blowing.
Well, and I am sure that is going to come through in the episode and I just cannot wait to see it. And additionally, Jay, another one of the episodes in season 7 prominently features ball jars. Is that true?
It's true. It was such a great opportunity because, you know, the Bob Ross Experience is at the Mini Trista Museum and Gardens, and the Mini Trista Museum is all about ball jars. And that's just one of my favorite things is a canning jar is such a great vessel for flowers. And that episode, we visited with Tanya there,
Tanya Saeed. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Tanya Saeed. And she told us about all the different types that are there. And they even brought out parts of their heritage collection for us to show off. One of the most valuable and rarest mason jar that is yellow.
Oh, wow. And Jay, what a joy it's been to talk with you today. It's been such a pleasure to learn about your life and your passion for flowers. And again, to share an avenue of art and artistic expression that maybe our viewers don't think about too much.
And my pleasure.
We can't wait until you join us again in Muncie for maybe more Bob Ross stuff.
Absolutely. I can't wait. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Jay. Jay Schwanke is a professional florist and the host of PBS's Life in Bloom. You can catch it on Ball State PBS Saturdays at 9 a.m. or on PBS Passport. You're listening to Pop of Culture. I'm Jen Blackmer.
And I'm Michelle Kinsey. We've been speaking this hour to florist Jay Schwanke, who filmed part of his PBS show, Life in Bloom, at Mini Trista Museum and Gardens. We recently toured their Crisis Canning Exhibition. The exhibition closes next Sunday, January 26th, so we thought we'd revisit it while we still
can.
So this is my first on-location interview, and I'm very excited to be here on location. Did I say I'm on location? On location here at Minna Trista Museum and Gardens, and I am sitting in the middle of an exhibit called Crisis Canning with the exhibit's designer, Hannah Bender. Hi, Hannah.
Hi, Jen. It's really great to have you here. Like you said, we are sitting in the exhibit, in the experience itself, and I'm so happy to have you here.
Well, we're excited to be here, and we're also really interested in the idea of a sort of a homegrown museum exhibit, because that's what this is. How did the idea begin? Can you give us a little bit about the history of Crisis Canning?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think homegrown, you hit it, you know, nail on the head.
That was a pun.
Yeah, I love it. So homegrown, that's what we were going for, I mean, in my own design for the space, but the exhibit itself was an idea based off of canning in times of crisis, really came to fruition through the COVID pandemic and seeing that resurgence in canning and being able to do it at home and reminding people of where canning came from. So here at Minna Trista, our curator at the time had this idea, and it's now become this beautiful exhibit. And it's just meant to share with people that canning has been around for centuries, and it's still here, and it's alive and well. And we're exhibiting different objects and collections items, both from Minna Trista's own collection and ones that we've borrowed from other museums as well, and highlighting how they were used or how they play into canning. So.
It really is a journey through history. Now, is this your first major museum exhibit? Because I know you've been here for a year. Is that right?
Yes, it is. Yeah. This is my first in-house exhibit, in-house history exhibit in a 3,000 square foot space. So, yes, lots of firsts.
Awesome. That's congratulations.
Thank you.
So how do you envision, you say a homegrown exhibit, right? That's what we're talking about. So how do you begin that process? What's the first thing you do?
First thing I do is look at the content that we're trying to get across to our visitors, and I pull from, you know, the collection items that we might be using, and that's kind of where I get inspiration for color palette and design. I might do some research about other designers, exhibit spaces, and how they kind of went about a similar project. Throughout the space, I've also incorporated different visual elements that help tie everything together. There are stencils of different vegetables and fruits throughout the exhibit on the walls.
Did you design those yourself?
So those are actually pulled from the graphic designer and his work on these panels on the wall here. So I pulled those off and brought them into the space further just to tie everything together.
That's excellent. What is the difference between this and an exhibit that you might bring in from somewhere else? How does the work doing this differ from that kind of an experience?
There's always different pros, cons, different things I enjoy and some that I don't with each thing. So with a leased exhibit, you know, you already have everything. But then the challenge there is you're fitting it into a space that it wasn't necessarily designed for. So that's enjoyable, but also a challenge. But with a homegrown exhibit, you're starting from scratch. So there's a lot more elbow grease that goes into something like that.
So now we're speaking with Kirsten Novotny, and Kirsten and I actually have known each other for quite some time. Isn't that not true?
Yeah, 14 years, I think.
Kirsten's actually a former student, and I am so proud of Kirsten and everything Kirsten's been able to do. So tell us what you do here at Minna Trista.
So I am the theater and events manager. Thank you to Jen. And I also put on our signature events, but I work to incorporate aspects of theater, live performances and shows into those various large events we have. And sometimes now I get to do actual museum theater within the space.
So what is museum theater? For people who have never experienced it, what is it?
Museum theater for me is really just getting to bring that live aspect to oftentimes, you know, more stagnant spaces and really get people to experience history and the various topics that we're covering in a way that's relatable to them, that brings them into the space, welcomes them with a story that allows them to conceptualize something and bring a reality to it that you wouldn't have otherwise.
Is this Sebastian?
Yes. To talk about a specific object.
Amazing.
Sure. Yeah.
So can we introduce you and interview you for Pop of Culture? That's what we're doing. We're featuring.
Sure.
You would love to? Amazing.
Sure.
So we're here with our curator of Crisis Canning and here at Minnetrista.
My name is Sebastian Encina.
Awesome. And we are standing in front of a number of, I guess you call them artifacts from World War II. Is that right?
That is correct. What we're standing in front of right now is one of the cases within Crisis Canning. Crisis Canning is divided into five separate stories, starting with the introduction, but then we go into World War I, Great Depression, World War II, Back to the Land, and COVID. Where we're standing right now is one of the cases for World War II.
Awesome. And what are some of the things of interest here?
What is really interesting about World War II is we see this in other eras, but what we're seeing here is a sense of patriotism. What is a citizen's duty in order to support the war effort? We have ration books because the government was encouraging people to not overeat or not consume more products than they should, because meats and flours and those kind of goods should be going to the soldiers fighting in the European battle or in the Asian theater. So we're having items that rekindle that sense of patriotism. What can you as an American be doing? So not only do we have the ration books, but as you look around this entire gallery, we chose a number of posters that have that same message. So right behind you is food is ammunition. So reminding people that every single little thing they can do is going to win the war.
Excellent. And then you said that there were five different stories, right, that throughout the gallery, and then the stories sort of move through time. And we end with COVID.
Correct.
And Hannah, the designer, was explaining that COVID was sort of the impetus for the Crisis Canning idea. So what are some of your thoughts about the story of COVID? How does this all kind of connect?
The connection, the underlying theme here is history reinventing itself, or history repeating itself. The message that we're seeing throughout is a sense of returning to traditional times, of gardening, of canning and food preservation in general. How can we do things in order to support our community, ourselves, our families? While World War I and World War II were a patriotic duty, we're looking at the Great Depression as a need. We're looking at the Back to the Land era of the 1970s as a crisis of conscience, of what can we do for the Earth, for Mother Earth, Earth Day. When it comes to COVID, we were limited into what we could do, where we can go, and going to the grocery store, I remember not being able to find bread flour because there was such a rush. Everybody had all this extra time and all this time at home. So they're thinking about how can we renovate our homes? What are hobbies that I can take at home as well? So we're seeing a pattern during COVID era where people are buying seeds, planting their own gardens. Well, now you have all these fruits and all these vegetables. What are you going to do with them? Because I can't cook them all.
That's right, yeah.
Well, how about if I just learn some canning? So what we also saw during COVID times is a rush on canning materials, particularly the lids.
That's right. I'm a knitter, and yarn actually experienced an uptick during the pandemic as well, which is it's fascinating to me and quite gratifying, actually, how we returned to traditional art forms and traditional hobbies and crafts and that type of thing during that particular time.
What I'm very curious about is how many people stuck with those hobbies.
That's exactly right, yes.
And so maybe people have learned how to knit, have learned how to can, have learned how to garden, but are they keeping that going? And when the next crisis comes, whatever that might be, are people going to have to relearn all of these lessons? So that's what you're seeing through here, is that people are relearning, 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 And we saw the same thing during COVID. And maybe in 20 years, we'll see it again. Hopefully not, but...
Hopefully not that way, definitely.
Yes. Correct.
Minatrista's Crisis Canning is open through January 26th.
Every week on Pop of Culture, we ask an artist, what are you working on? This week, our co-host Kara Duquette spoke to a musician who's just released their debut album.
We are here with Dana Powell. She is a Canadian singer, songwriter, and pianist now living in Indiana. Dana's first full-length country pop album, Your Love Is Enough, was released a few months ago in August 2024. Thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to ask, what are you working on now?
Ooh, so right now, I actually just got the first kind of demo draft of my new single that's coming out in January from the producer this morning. So Ooh. The first time I heard it, and I am like, I am freaking out. It sounds so good.
Nice. Yeah. Have you worked with this producer before?
Okay, or? Funny story. Okay. So I used to be a music director on cruise ships. I used to work on cruise ships, played in bands, and Carl, who owns Brickshed Studios in Fort Wayne, was actually the drummer in our band. This was like 10 years ago. I've not heard from him. I've not talked to him since then. I moved to Indiana, found out he lived here. We reconnected, and now he's producing my next single, and it is amazing.
It's a small world after all.
Exactly.
That's crazy exactly. story. Mm-hmm. So what was the inspiration behind this single?
So the song is called Where Would We Be? And the inspiration behind it is when you get that feeling where you are maybe overwhelmed or just some part of you just wants to give up and quit. And the song is based around that. So where would we be if you gave up whenever things got hard, if you quit, if you didn't say what you want to say at the time. So that's what the song is inspired by.
Oh, I'm looking very forward to hearing it. I could use a little bit of that motivation right now in my own life.
Oh.
It's okay.
Yeah.
Things will be all right.
They will be. And a lot of the times, you know, that where you get to that point, you just push past a little bit more and then... You know, it just, then you look back in a few months and go, oh my gosh, I can't believe I was going to give up on that.
Did you want to talk to us a little bit about your album that dropped this summer, Your Love Is Enough?
Sure. So I was working on that album a long time, writing those songs. So I had all the musicians and I got it all together and I got the guitar and the drums and everything. And then by the time I had recorded all the parts, I'm like, okay, now I have no money to produce this and mix this album. So I thought, okay, I'm just going to have to do it all myself. So I did. Nice. And it's got a very much, you know, live performance sound. It's very acoustic sound. So for that album. So what I'm working on in the future is to get more of a commercial sound, but that album there is very much stripped down.
Well, I hope that people give it a listen. Talked a little bit about some of your motivation for your single that's coming out. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about where do you think you're going as you move forward in your career with Ooh, music.
Well, I mean, there's where I hope I'm going.
Great.
I can talk about that.
Let's talk about that.
So I really am really trying to break out onto the commercial radio scene. And I know that is extremely, it's very, very hard. But that's where I'm focused right now, is kind of the commercial adult contemporary slash country markets and live performance.
Well, as you talk about breaking into commercial music, what is your genre? Right, I mean, I know your album, Your Love Is Enough, is country pop, but what kind of, are you going to stay in that genre? Are you looking at other genres?
Yeah, I'm going to stay in that genre. It's kind of like crossover, because you can, I mean, if you listen to country radio right now, there's a lot of pop, right? Like pop sounding elements. It's still country, but it's very poppy. So it's kind of like in that genre. Maybe Lauren Elena. I love Tennille Arts. I love Carly Pierce. And I also love Adele. So it's like, it's kind of, those are my influence, big influences. So it's in that area.
Okay. Yeah, I do think that the genres are starting to blur. I don't know.
Right.
Like you said, a lot of crossover.
Yeah, and I think happening. That comes a lot too from like the digital side of things, right? Mm-hmm. Adding all these digital elements into your music can really, maybe not broaden, but just reach maybe a broader audience.
Yeah, and you might hear a song that you just pick up and put on a playlist, and suddenly mm-hmm. you're listening to all sorts of genres.
Right.
So
yeah, and I came from, so my background is actually, I went to college for jazz piano. Oh. So this is I've gone through, I put actually, you know, recorded jazz before, and then I decided I don't want to record jazz and I want to do pop and country music. But all of those influences, you know, combined produce that sound.
Yeah.
Drawn from a lot of different influences.
I really like it when people have an eclectic mix of their experiences that shows through in their
yeah.
work.
Yeah. Well, I think that's like the only way to write, right? Is from your own, to really write authentically. It's like from your own personal experiences.
Yeah, I would completely agree with that. Where can people find you currently online?
Oh, everything is listed on my website, danapowellmusic.com. So, you know, wherever you, Spotify, Apple Music, Instagram, Facebook, wherever you want to go, it's all there.
And I have a question for you. So do you miss Canada? Do you miss Canada at all? Or have you adjusted to life in Indiana?
Oh, I definitely miss Canada. Like, I definitely miss parts. There's things I miss for sure. There's also things here that are just that I love too. So it's, you know, it's trade-offs. It's like, obviously my family's in Canada, so that's a big one for
sure.
Me, right? But I like that it's warmer here. The summers are longer. It's easy to get to different cities here. The music scene is better. Sorry, okay. I don't know if I should say that, but
that's
yeah.
wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, and we'll look forward to hearing more from you.
Thank you so much. But I won't lose hope, won't lose sight of all the beauty in this life. There are times when it's so hard to see, but then you show me. You show me. You show me.
All right, Jen, it's time for the arts calendar. Shall we see what's going on?
I'm buckled in, Michelle.
All right, here
we
go.
I'm buckled in.
Here we go. Muncie Civic Theater will have auditions this weekend for two upcoming shows. Auditions for Jesus Christ Superstar will be at 10 a.m. Saturday, January 18th at the Downtown Theater. And auditions for The Importance of Being Earnest will be 3 p.m. this Sunday, January 19th. More info at MuncieCivic.org. This is your opportunity to get out there and try your hand at some theater.
You should totally do it, and I love both of those shows.
Yes.
It's going to be great. Harmony Movement Studio is hosting swing dance nights on Thursdays at the Downtown Muncie Studio. The dancing begins at 6 p.m. The next one is Thursday, January 23rd.
The Y Store, if you were around Muncie's Village in the 1990s, you know exactly who I'm talking about, will be among the performers at a benefit concert Friday, January 17th at the Room 5 Piano Bar in Muncie. Other performers will include Mike Martin, Smoking Horses, and Mr. Asylum. Proceeds will provide aid and resources for Hurricane Helene survivors in Western North Carolina.
Hotel California, a salute to the Eagles. You can check out, but you can never leave. We'll take the stage at the Paramount Theater in Anderson on Friday, January 17th at 7:30 p.m. By respectfully and accurately reproducing the award-winning sounds of the Eagles, this Southern California group has touched the hearts of fans all over the world. More info at andersonparamount.org.
On Saturday, January 18th at 3 p.m., the Delaware County Historical Society will present a presentation about super bandit Gerald Chapman, who was captured in Muncie on January 18th, 1925. Muncie resident David Bailey will provide a video presentation on the life, crimes, and capture of Chapman on the 100-year anniversary of his capture in Muncie. The presentation will be held at the Delaware County Historical Society at 120 East Washington Street.
I never knew about that. That sounds fascinating. All right. As part of its Arts Alive series, Ball State University will welcome renowned writer and performer Daniel Alexander Jones to campus on Friday, January 24th. The event is open to the public, and it'll begin at 7:30 p.m. Daniel Alexander Jones' body of original work includes award-winning plays, performance pieces, recorded music, concerts, music theater events, essays, and long-form improvisations. BSU.edu is the place to go for more info. Daniel Alexander Jones is marvelous.
My goodness, that list, and it's just like a fraction of what this individual has accomplished.
Absolutely.
What an amazing opportunity for Ball State and the community.
We're pleased to have him here in town.
Mounds State Park invites you to paint in the park on Saturday, January 25th. Park Place Arts will lead the step-by-step painting class in the Mounds State Park Nature Center in Anderson. All supplies and instruction are provided. Reservations must be made at parkplacearts.com.
If you have an event that our listeners should know about, tell us at indianapublicradio.org/contact, then click Pop of Culture.
Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by Psi Iota Xi. Additional support comes from the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, and sustaining members of IPR. You can support local programming today at indianapublicradio.org.
And that's our show. This episode was produced by Luke Jones, who loves receiving flowers. Who doesn't, right? And was hosted by me, Jen Blackmer.
And me, Michelle Kinsey. Pop of Culture is a production of IPR on the campus of Ball State University.